And welcome to Let the Bird Fly, a podcast about living freely in a world given back to us. My name's Mike and Peter. This is the dawn of a new day.
Viva la revolución.
If you've been listening, you know that Wade is not on this podcast, and he was worried that he was not going to be here this week because he thought there may be a revolution.
He heard the grumblings of the underground. We played it coy, and we got him out of the state and out of his office, and we took over.
And as an act of symbolism, we are still recording in his office.
Yeah, we're not going to give up the equipment that he purchased.
Absolutely not. Today with us, we have Peter, you've heard, myself, and then also my wife, Amanda Berg, because our topic today is going to be about grace in the schoolroom. And so we're going to have Peter, an educator, and Amanda, an educator, really kind of go back and forth, and I'm going to fade in the background, hopefully, as they talk about not just education, but specifically, how do you do grace in the classroom? So, Amanda, could you say hi?
Hello.
Thank you. All right. Now, we also have Mini Amanda, also known as Noelle Berg. Can you say hi?
Hi.
And then we have Oliva.
I'm back.
Oliva is also here. Oliva, hello.
Hello.
It's nice to have you here. So before we get any further, we're going to go right to our disclaimer that's going to be read by our two sweethearts here in the office today.
This show does not speak for our churches, our church bodies, or our employers.
To be honest, much of the time, it probably doesn't speak for us.
We will be thinking out loud a lot.
So approach what you hear with a healthy skepticism, because, well, as a responsible resident of planet Earth, that's probably what you should generally do with almost everything.
If you find yourself getting too worked up, tune out, look around, and realize you are just listening to a podcast. That's right, a podcast.
So go live free, friends, and don't let us get in the way.
Thank you, girls. And with that, we're going to move to our scripture narrative. Back with our scripture narrative, and Peter, I have a confession to make. I'm already done with the revolution. I feel guilt-ridden, and to make it up to Wade, our scripture reading is going to be from Mark.
Yeah, this is no good. I mean, Mark's he's just going to get a big head now. He's going to think, yep, see, it's all about Mark. Mark is so short, too. We should be able to just get past this. I mean, at some point, I think, by rights, we're gonna have to have covered all of the gospel.
Right, we'll be done, and we'll have to move to Luke.
Or maybe another one.
Yeah, we'll Matthew. Is there another one?
There is, yeah. It's another one. Covers some different things. It's got a nice, you know, beautiful structure to it. And
you'll have to tell me about that one
someday. We'll talk about it, yeah.
All right. From Mark chapter 10. People were bringing little children to Jesus to have him touch them, but the disciples rebuked them. When Jesus saw this, he was indignant. He said to them, "Let the little children come to me, and do not hinder them, for the kingdom of God belongs to such as these. I tell you the truth, anyone who will not receive the kingdom of God like a little child will never enter it." And he took the children in his arms, put his hands on them, and blessed them. When we hear this portion of scripture that we all know pretty well, I think, I know it almost by heart because it's part of Luther's baptismal rite. And so we read it just about at every baptism we did for the last 12 years in my parish. And such a beautiful part of scripture. And when we hear it, we rightfully go right to the idea of faith, that faith is not something that we do, that we offer up to God, but it is something God gives to us. And he says, look at these little children. These are the ones that understand what faith is, not a jaded adult. But today I want to kind of take a little different tact on this text because we're going to be talking about grace in the classroom. Sometimes even very mature Christians, they really don't trust Jesus. And if we just have a little bit too much grace, too much Jesus, then things are going to go awry. And so you can think in the Reformation about what are you going to do when you give grace to all of these Germans or all these people in Europe? Who knows? Everybody's going to be doing everything that they're not supposed to be doing if you don't have the strict law. And I wonder if we do that in the classrooms too, that we don't allow that freedom. And certainly you have to have class discipline and stuff like that. But you wonder about these kids, where they ever get undeserved love, where they ever get grace. And we tend to say that grace is just not enough. It's just not going to be enough. They have to have the structure. They have to have this law. They have to have this, that, or the other thing. And it's true enough. But as we know, the law can really swallow up the gospel really quick. And in place of that, true gospel becomes kind of a fake gospel. It becomes positive thinking. It becomes, let's just be nice for a little bit, a veneer of gospel that's really just covering up a moralism. And so it's good to come back and see these disciples saying, oh, you don't have time to be bothered with these children. You know where these children need to be? They need to be out in the distance. They need to be quiet and all this kind of stuff. And Jesus says, no, let the little children come to me. And he puts them on his knee, and he pays attention to them. Grace is for them, too, and something for us parents and for us teachers to always keep in mind. With that, we're going to go to our free-for-all before we get into the main topic.
And we're back with the free-for-all, where we wrestle with the pressing questions of life and try to settle them once and for all. Today, if everything goes as planned, this will either come out, this episode will be released on Halloween Day or All Saints Day Eve or Reformation Day, depending on your predisposition, I guess. But we're gonna tackle some Halloween questions for this free-for-all. Because it'll be at least around that time. And we have two middle schoolers in the office, so this should be a lot of fun. So the first thing we want to discuss is on Halloween, generally, historically in the United States, the rich Halloween tradition that we have, you get candy. You go to people's houses, you knock on strangers' doors, and you say, hey.
Or like the Saturday before, because, you know, it's on a Tuesday.
Hey, I'm setting this up, okay, Oliva?
Okay.
All right, thank you. You go and you knock on the stranger's door, and then you say, hey, do you have anything, you know, have any candy? And it's the one time a year, unless you're Wade's kids, that your parents say it's okay to take candy from strangers. And in fact, we encourage you to do it. And just to make it a little more creepy, we say, hey, get dressed up first, right? And so we have all these people dressed up, and we're encouraging kids. I don't know. It just seems like some bad, you know, habits that we might be forming. But you get the candy, then you come home and you, you know, sort through it all. And then, you know, as a kid, I remember this very clearly, you have to decide which candy, you start trading with your siblings probably, which candies are really valuable and which ones are, you know, kind of, you know, garbage. Like, you know, you have to separate the wheat from the chaff. So, Noelle and Oliva, I'll let you two start it off. What are the best and what are the worst Halloween candies?
Well, this Halloween, I got something that I had no idea what was, and there were some sort of giant gumdrops, and I despise gumdrops. So I think gumdrops, and I think they were called Chuckles, are
Chuckles?
Pretty disgusting.
I went to grade school with a kid whose nickname was Chuckles, but it's probably not the same thing as the candy. So what do you not like about gumdrops? What's wrong with gumdrops?
I don't know. I don't like the sugary stuff on the outside sometimes, but I don't like the texture. It's gross.
I don't know. I mean, growing up, that was like going to my grandma's house. That's a bowl full of them, right?
And they get kind of hard.
Yeah, or they melt, and like if you sit on one and stuff, that would be terrible.
Ew.
So that's your worst. Oliva, what's your worst, or what are some of your worst?
There aren't a lot of candies that I don't like, but ones that are just mostly made out of sugar. Like, I know they're all sugar, but like I like chocolate, but not like those sugar sticks. Those are disgusting.
The sugar sticks, like the little sticks that you just pour the sugar into your mouth?
Yeah.
And they like flavor it and pretend like it's not just sugar?
Mostly, yeah.
I don't know. I think they call those pixie sticks. I always like those.
Those are good.
Those are disgusting.
Those are good.
Those are gross.
This is high-level debate going on here. So, Mike, go ahead.
I was going to say, we went trick-or-treating today in Wisconsin. For those of you outside of the state, sometimes in some places they trick-or-treat the Sunday before during the afternoon, and we got an orange from our neighbor, and Amanda thinks it's safe. I'm not quite sure.
Yeah, I don't know. I'd be a little skeptical of that.
Yeah, I don't know about
She's
that.
She's a Seems really like, nice neighbor.
Yeah, that's what she wants you to think.
Yeah, that's
she
right.
Orange we for know Halloween. This
She's been setting it up for months.
Hey. She's playing the long game here.
It came with rubber duckies and tights, too, so, yeah, you know, see, this, that's pretty normal. Right.
That does not make me feel better.
We could do that too. Like, what are other than candy? What are some of the things you got? But let's girls. What do you think? What's your favorite candies? Oliva, you already kind of touched on it, but.
Well, I like all chocolates, but I think my favorite above all is Reese's Pieces peanut butter cups.
Yeah, chocolate and
then,
peanut butter,
and then Kit Kats comes next.
What about the new Reese's? Like the Butterfinger Reese's cups that when they combine them.
I don't think I've had that yet.
Oh, well,
you're missing out.
Yeah, you're going to have a new favorite.
Those are delicious.
When we lived with my grandparents, my favorite house to stop at was there was one around the corner of the street, and he had a big basket of huge candy bars, and you could pick one.
Yeah, it was the full-size candy bars?
Yeah, it was so
cool. You circle around, hit that house two or three times, you know. What about you, Noelle? What's your favorite?
I have three favorites, but I'm only going to do one. I love Charleston chews.
Charleston chews, okay.
Especially when they're frozen.
Who taught you that?
My mom.
What about black licorice? Do either of you like black licorice?
No.
That stuff's gross.
What?
I like the strawberry and cherry Twizzler licorice.
Werther's Originals?
Yes, it has to be the Twizzler licorice. That's the best.
Oh, but the black kind? They make
the
black
cherry
Twizzlers.
Kind.
Oh, cherry, okay. What about Werther's Originals?
Those are really yummy, especially the coffee flavored ones.
Oh, okay. See, yeah. I thought that maybe I'd get a yuck.
What are those?
There. They're like the candy that old men try to give you.
Don't take them.
What? My dad always had the coffee flavor ones.
I was going to say, your dad had, that doesn't surprise me.
Well, I haven't had those, but I'm just going to guess that they're gross, so.
They are really good.
You'll have to ask Dr. Berg for some. evidently, he's one of these old men that carries around. Amanda and Mike, what about you?
I would say my favorite, I'm going to have to go with the classic Snickers. Anything with peanuts and caramel and chocolate, I'm with Oliva. Chocolate is always good. Probably my worst or the least favorite are those orange and black wrapped little peanut butter flavored taffies.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And I think I liked them for a short period of time, but then you would just get so many of them, and it was always like a disappointment when you saw a couple of those drop into your bag. So those would probably be my best and my worst.
Like, do you want to tell the people, all right, yeah, turn the light off, all right?
Yeah.
Everyone's done here.
I like Rolos. And my least favorite, I don't know. There's a lot out there. Sugar Sticks. Yeah, I'm with you, Oliva. They're kind of gross.
They're just gross. You just pour sugar into your mouth.
No, the worst part about, I don't mind pouring sugar into my mouth. The worst part is that if you accidentally get the end of the sugar stick on your mouth, it gets wet and then it gets clogged up and then you can't get the rest of the sugar out. And then, of course, you have, tearing it and then it spills all over the place and your mom yells at you. You get grounded for a week or two. Things spiral out of control pretty quickly. But it's worth it for the pixie sticks.
That just happened to me this afternoon.
So, did you give me both your favorite and least favorite?
I did.
Rolos and
I did.
You said
the Pixie Sticks.
Pixie Sticks, yeah.
I used to like Pixie Sticks. I remember in Texas, I went to my friend's party, and she had a fairy birthday party because we were both really young. But she had a fairy party, so of course they
When was you were really young? When did this happen?
This is
where was I?
What?
How did I not know about this?
You were there.
Oh, okay. Never mind.
But then. She had a fairy party, and so. There was candy, and of course it was Pixie Sticks, so I used to like them.
Okay, thank you. That was interesting. We appreciate that. Peanut butter and chocolate.
That was a good story that had a beginning, and it had a middle.
It was just missing, what was that?
I think it's just beginning and middle. That was it, right?
Yeah.
Is there something else?
I don't think so.
Okay.
Yeah, okay. Moving on. Anything with chocolate and peanut butter, I'll eat it. I love peanut butter and chocolate. They go together. This is like married in heaven, right? And so anything like that. But let's be honest. I mean, if it's sugar, I'm probably eating it. So, you know, you go through, get the candy bars, you know, any of the, you know, the Snickers are great, Mars bars, Kit Kats, just kind of go through
anything
all those.
Anything with chocolate.
Eventually, you work your way into the hard candy, you know, and I'm okay with hard candy. When I was in grade school, we used to take the, what are those called? The Smarties. And we had the desks where the tops lifted up, you know, and so you put your stuff inside there, and we would set them right on the edge of the desk.
Pencil holder.
And the pencil holder area, but right where the top is actually going to hit it, and you crush the Smartie. And then we would have powdered Smartie, which is just sugar, of course. But
Pixie
we have
sticks. Powdered,
yeah. And then we would, like, you know, either, you know, put it on our fingers and, like, you know, eat little bits of it, or you'd snort it or do something else disgusting with it, right? But so I remember Smarties was always a big one. Those we always had plenty of, too. It's always the cheap candy that, you know, people get, and those are the last ones.
Super classy, Pete.
Oh, yeah.
Super
classy. We were fantastic. When I started teaching, this
I've
maybe
heard
a
too many
precursor.
Of that kind of story.
Yeah, I know. little teaser for the topic, maybe. But when I was in middle school, I was a little hellion, and when I taught middle school for the first time, my mom told me, she's like, "Oh man, Mr. Zavel is you gotta let him know. He's gonna feel like vindicated that you have to deal with the middle schoolers now." and I was really concerned about this because I remembered how I was in middle school, and my middle schoolers were great. And so I came home at, you know, Christmas time or whenever I saw my mom, and I said, "Yeah, you know what? Thing is, world's not fair. Like, I got the good ones. I didn't have to deal with me." So, but yeah, that's the kind of stuff that I did. I don't even know how, like, thinking back, Halloween, Easter, kids come back, there was candy just like everywhere. It was just like, you know, what's a candy shop called? Like a, there's a name for it, but it was like, that was what the room was. It was like candy everywhere, hidden in every desk, every book, everywhere you could find. And the kids were just bouncing off the walls, but I don't know. Kids, what are you going to do with them? Mm-hmm. All right, so moving on to
I feel like there's a beginning and a middle to that story. No, I'm just kidding.
Ouch. Moving on, the next question, I think that I'll be very interested to hear what Noelle and Oliva have to say about this, but a question that comes up every year as parents, and how old is too old for your kids to go trick-or-treating? So I think we'll start with we'll start with the kids here. Why don't you start us off again?
My mom thinks my sister's too old, and she's 14. But my personal opinion is you're never too old to go trick-or-treating. Like, unless you look too old.
So how would you look too old? Like, does your dad look too old?
No, my sister does not look too old to be trick-or-treating.
So
is what I'm
deceiving
trying to say.
People then.
So she can pass as a younger child,
yes,
a younger kid?
That's what I'm saying.
So could your dad go trick-or-treating?
If he has like a costume? Yes.
So he just needs to cover his face?
See, yes.
Close back to this, Halloween is kind of a creepy time, right?
You don't
have
to.
We have people like your dad out there, hidden, you don't even know he's creepy as him, and we're just behind a mask.
I will let my 14-year-old go trick-or-treating. Sorry, Mom.
I think that none of us are baby goats, so...
Oh.
But anyway, I think that everybody can go trick-or-treating, but you can't go dressed, like, if you're a dad, you can't go dressed as a dad. Because, like, you
Why
always
not?
Say, I think I'm just going to go dressed as a dad this year, but you can't really do that.
But I'm really good at that.
That's not the point.
I nail that costume.
Are you saying
every
year? You got to put some effort into it? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I'm kind of saying the same thing as Noelle.
My dad always said he was being a pastor for Halloween.
But in my opinion, everybody deserves candy.
Oh, that's so nice. So who's going to hand out the candy if everyone goes trick-or-treating?
Well,
maybe the kids should. Maybe the adults should go trick-or-treating.
I guess that people that don't have kids don't usually go out. Like, so then they stay and they get the candy.
You know,
I don't know.
On a radio show this week, you know, it's like a filler topic. So the host was saying, I think that if you have kids and you're going to go out and get candy, that you are obligated to hand out candy. And I just thought, it doesn't even make sense. You're not at home. You're out, you know, trick-or-treating with your kids. Like, how do you
I heard that,
you
too,
that?
And that it's just, it doesn't make sense.
You must listen to a lot of the same radio
just
I do.
Just leave a bull out there with a sign. When I was trick-or-treating, there was about six or seven houses where they had a little sign with like take two or take three.
And was the bowl empty?
No.
Oh, I hadn't been passed yet.
It was full.
That, I always tell my dad that we should just do that. And then he's like, yeah. And then one person comes along and suddenly the bowl's empty.
Yep. That's my experience with it.
But we live in Wauwatosa.
That's right.
But the bad part of Wauwatosa.
Yeah, it is. It's getting rough. Got people like Oliva living there. So, mom and dad, how old is too old? It sounds like you've already been broaching this topic.
I think we sort of decided definitely once you're out of elementary school, grade school, which for our kids it's through eighth grade, too old. I think the last time I remember trick-or-treating, though, was definitely seventh grade, except for the one time I went as a freshman in college. But I feel like
so
it's
morphed.
So you
can go as a freshman in college, but your freshman in high school can't go?
Right, because once you're out on your own, you're making your own decisions.
Well, and your own mistakes, right?
Yeah, so. Exactly. And, you know, we weren't necessarily doing it to get the candy. We were just out to have some fun and dress up, and a lot of people got a kick out of it. And it was a cold, dark night in New Ulm, Minnesota,
well,
as I remember,
you could,
but it was fun.
Still now, paid off as an eighth grader, so... Just saying.
Noelle is almost as tall as you.
This is true. I'm short, for those of you that don't know. It's not any news flash for most of the people in this room. But my stature could be on my side when it comes to trick-or-treating.
It is sometimes hard on a podcast to judge height. So
yes.
It is. I think we should just be done with Halloween, because I'm sick of doing it. So whatever my kid's age is next year, that's the age that I want to stop trick-or-treating. Actually, I had fun today.
Sophia's like 9 or 10 next year.
Yeah,
she's
that's going to be rough on her.
Sometimes the youngest gets forced into growing up a little bit too fast. If the older ones are done and over with, then they're kind of the straggler.
I just realized next Halloween I'm going to be 13. Wow.
Whoa. Too old.
Yes. No. I want to be old. No.
Well, you know, the good news.
I want to be 13 next year.
We'll get there. This is taking an odd turn.
Yeah.
Noelle, the good news is that even if you're not allowed to go trick-or-treating, I understand that your dad has a pocket full of Werther's Originals, and so maybe he'll share them with you. All right? So that's always, it's kind of like Halloween every day. In fact, I've got a good story about that. When I was growing up, we lived in a lot of different houses growing
up. I thought
up.
This was taking a turn.
I know, I'm trying to get it back in the right track, Oliva. I've tried to save this from you. So we lived in a lot of different houses growing up, but one of the houses, and that would have been until I was in second grade, or just through second grade, that we lived in, our next door neighbor, it was an elderly lady and gentleman who weren't able to have kids. They loved kids. And so they actually had a bowl of candy all year round in their front, you know, like breezeway. And you go knock on their door and you would, you know, say, you know, hi, Pinky. Her nickname was Pinky because she always wore a pink wig. And she would say, you'd say, hi, Pinky, can we have some candy? And she had a very strict rule. It was once a day, but you could go and get candy from her. So it was like Halloween every day. You can go knock on Pinky and John's
door.
That
would be awesome.
I know, it was, yeah. And I didn't get to test it, but I've wondered now, you know, as I got older, how long would have she given me candy? We only were there until I was through second grade. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I'm going like seventh, eighth grade, knocking on the door. I'm like, hey, Pinky. And she's like, no, your voice has changed. All right, so I would say Oliva's 11 right now. She's in sixth grade. I think we're getting really close. I think my last year trick-or-treating was seventh grade, if I remember correctly.
Nope.
And I remember it really...
Not happening. I have three little sisters. One of them has not gone up and knocked on a door yet. I have to be with her when she does that. That's not going to be for a few years.
That's different. You don't need to be in costume and have a bag with you.
So. No.
You're just there as an escort.
I would do that, though. I would have a bag.
No.
That's something that I would do, or Abigail would do.
It's changing, though, because some neighborhoods do, like, treats for the adults as you go around, too. So,
yeah.
It's kind of a family event. In our town that we came from in Minnesota, it was a small town, and pretty much everybody knew each other. And trick-or-treating was always Halloween night. So everybody was out and about, and it, you know, friends would stop in, visit for a little bit, have a beverage or a snack of the adult nature, and the kids would get their treats too. So I guess it just depends on how you all roll with it as a family.
That's not a bad gig.
I remember that apple cider. That was so yummy.
It was delicious.
When I was in graduate school, I went to a Catholic graduate school, and so I always would, like my friends would say, you know, like, you do anything for Halloween? And I said, you mean for Reformation Day? Just to, you know, just to twist a little bit. But I always thought going as Martin Luther would be a little cliche and yet, you know, a lot of fun. Like, walk around, and when people get a knock on the door, and you usually say, trick or treat, of course. You say, Happy Reformation Eve, yeah. Evening. Like, see what people say.
See if it catches on.
All right, anyone have anything else? Should we move on to our main topic, why the listeners are really here? Seeing none, we'll get on to the main topic, Grace in the Classroom.
We're back with our main topic. Today we wanted to talk about education, specifically grace in the classroom. How would that look, and is it even possible? And today we invited Amanda Berg here to talk about that. And Amanda, why don't you fill us in on your credentials as a teacher?
Okay, thank you. So I guess I'm in my 16th year of teaching, if I'm counting correctly. And
hope you would be, because you're an educator.
This is true. I went to Martin Luther College in New Ulm, Minnesota. I did a double major in the way it works there as far as elementary education, and I added an early childhood education degree, which was an extra year of training, about 18 credits in addition to additional student teaching. And the majority of my teaching career has been in the world of early childhood education, mostly pre-primary or preschool level. And the schools that I had been at, I actually participated in starting all of those programs as well. So it wasn't just coming into a preschool setting, but it was starting from scratch. And particularly the last 12 years, we had done that at our church in Woodlake and started a preschool program there. In a town of a little over 400 people, and we had no idea what it was going to look like or become over the course of the years there, but the 11 years that we were operating, we saw a lot of blessings and successes through that, and really enjoyed what we got to shape there and watch happen, and we're thankful that the Lord has continued to keep that program going in Woodlake. I am now switching gears just a little bit, teaching kindergarten in the urban setting in Milwaukee. And sounds like it wouldn't be that much different, but believe it or not, a jump from preschool to kindergarten is a pretty big one, especially in our society today and what we all expect out of kindergartners. And so I guess that wraps it up for me.
No, that's good. And just to maybe point out, not just on the education side, but having been a part of the administrative side too, which means you saw some big picture things as well. You weren't just an employee, you were kind of big picture too.
True. I was technically the director in many of those situations. For sure in Woodlake, it was just myself and Mike running the show. And I also participated in
so that means you pretty much ran the show.
It was
show,
me
right?
running the
I'm
show.
I'm assuming Mike
yeah.
did very little.
Although he was always
I
there
did
to
bathroom runs.
Yeah. And to get them all wound up. But and I also worked in our public school district there for a couple of years as the early childhood education director. And so a lot of eye-opening things and experiences for me in that role as well. And what that role also taught me is it connected me to resources that are available. So I learned a lot through that, but it also reminded me how important God's word is when we are dealing with education, and how there's kind of that constant void in the public sector. And not to say that it should be brought in there, but I guess I just really noticed that they were striving for something, but without being able to use the gospel or God's word, you're missing that link that gives you that next connection, especially when it comes to talking about behavior and discipline and love in the classroom.
Good, thank you. And Peter, why don't you remind the listeners, you are also an educator, have a past in education, and kind of a unique one too. So why don't you fill them in again?
Yeah, I don't know that I've given like the whole rundown in the past, but I think I've touched on all the points. So I didn't get a degree in education in any way whatsoever. Just in the liberal arts in different areas, and then graduate school in philosophy. When my kids started school, when my kids started school, we had a had them at a private school and needed to be able to afford that. And one of the ways that we could do that is I could teach there. They had an opening for a middle school Greek teacher, and I had a little bit of Greek, so it worked out well. And so I started out, my first teaching job was actually teaching middle school, which, as I mentioned in the free-for-all, was a little terrifying because I know how I was as a middle schooler. And I was fortunate, I was very blessed to not have Greek myself.
Greek's one of the easier classes to teach middle school. That's what I've heard.
Well, these middle schoolers had had Greek for a while. My sixth graders, at that time, they started Greek in first grade. So we were actually starting a new textbook. It was a... kind of a standard college textbook, at least at the time. And so we went through it pretty slowly, but they were complaining that it was too, like, why are we going so slowly, Mr. Hermanson? We've already been through this. I was like, all right, we'll get to the second declension. Just, we got to get through the first, right? It was fun. I loved that. That was the hardest part of, that was in Texas at a classical school, actually, where if you listen to episode 18, we had Dr. Jason Merritt on. He was the headmaster there, and he, we talked about that there, but it's a classical school where they taught Greek and Latin. It was wonderful. It was one of the hardest parts of leaving Texas was leaving this school. Then we moved up to Wisconsin, found another school for the girls that was in the classical tradition, not exactly classical like the school in Texas, but they didn't have Greek, sadly, so I didn't have the opportunity to teach Greek, but they asked if I would teach history, and I thought, well, that's good. I can do history. I've got degrees in the liberal arts and covered these areas, but it was middle school again, which I at first was terrified of. And when we were in Texas, now I was excited about it. I was like, great, give me these middle schoolers again. We'll whip them into shape. And so I taught middle school history, then U.S. history in particular for a few years there. And then my other education experience as an educator would be at the college level. So, and that's philosophy. So, there you go.
That's very impressive, but not as impressive as preschool and kindergarten.
Absolutely not. No, I thought middle school, that I've actually said, I look at those little kids, preschool, kindergarten, even first grade, second grade, I can start understanding how teachers do it. But even that, I just think their kids are still crying. They're wetting their pants. I can't do that.
I was going to say, almost all middle schoolers don't wet their pants anymore.
No, I mean, occasionally, yeah, it happens, but they usually see it as a bad thing. Second graders maybe are like, well, it happens. What am I going to do about it?
When I subbed, I've taught every grade level all the way up through high school in substitute teaching anyway. And I found myself saying many of the same things to four-year-olds as well as 14 or 17-year-olds, like, keep your hands to yourselves. Don't talk when the teacher's talking. Those kinds of things. So, you know, maybe that's a good segue into what we're discussing today.
Pull your pants up.
Yeah, you know, I mean, honestly, you're treating them in many ways similarly. But I would have to agree with you. Middle school was the toughest. They're kind of in that awkward stage of trying to figure things out. And so I think that's when they tend to try to push more buttons.
Yeah.
By the time they get to high school, they've kind of figured themselves out a little bit. So they just sit back and relax and, you know, soak it up for the most part.
Yeah, no, and I will say that for me, teaching middle school, what I discovered was that they're in that awkward stage, but at the same, they're still children, and in some ways much more children than adults, but they're also on the precipice of adulthood, and they're entering into that. It's a very liminal time in their development. And I found as an educator at that level that I could really push them, and I could say, hey, you know, do you want to be a child, or do you want to be an adult, right? Do you want to be a man or a woman, depending on the student? Do you want to be a child? And of course they want to be adults, right? That's what they're pushed to. So it becomes very motivating for them. And then that kind of gave me the platform then to really challenge them academically as well. But this goes back to the whole thing, right? I mean, what's motivating them there? What's pushing them towards that direction, right? Do you want to be called a kid or child? Do you want to be, you know, kind of ridiculed in that way or not? And that's a legalistic tendency that you're trying to push them with, even if it's, you know, in the end for a good thing. It still is saying, this is what you have to work towards.
Yeah, and that kind of gets us back to our main point now that we've done introductions, and that's grace in the classroom. And so maybe I'll put it to both of you. Maybe, Peter, you want to go first on this one. Is it even possible? School is a law and order kind of thing. Grace is an undeserved love, specifically the forgiveness of sins. Is there a place at all? Can you even do it?
when you first brought this question up to me, it really kind of struck me because I hadn't thought of it in these terms before. But it really is, I mean, a difficult question. At least for me, it was difficult to kind of wrap my head around, because it is about law and structure. I mean, the first thing that I do when I have a new class in middle school is I have to set the boundaries, and I'm sure you're doing the same thing in with the little kids.
Yeah, very true. And practicing procedures from day one.
Right. And so for the middle schoolers, they know to keep their hands to themselves. So, you know, I mean, I have to remind them, of course, but they know that already, so I can take it for granted and then just reprimand them. But when can they talk? When can they, you know, when is it that they need to raise their hand? When do they need to, you know, be quiet? When do they need to recognize, you know, I'm running behind and I'm going faster for a reason? When do they have to realize this is really important? When do they have to realize, oh, I should probably be taking notes on this? This is just Mr. Hermanson, you know, bloviating again. I can kind of tune out all of these questions. And especially with the middle schoolers, what I found is that they've got that struggle between childhood and adulthood. And so especially with the boys, at least in my experience, I have had some girls that have the same struggle, the boys almost to a boy, is they want to goof around. They just want to be kind of goofy, and yet they want to like do what's right in a sense. They want to, you know, participate in the class. And so when they get the goofing around gets the better of them, I just, you know, send them out in the hallway, you know, get out. And, you know, sometimes they'll be like, what, why are you doing this? And I say, I'm not interested in you being in the room right now because I'm trying to teach and you're doing the opposite of that. You're making it impossible for anyone else who wants to be here. I'm only teaching the students who want to be here right now. And that usually has the double effect of kind of shaming the student as they walk out of the room, but also getting the other students to kind of sit up straight, right? But here's the thing, as a teacher, I don't want them to be listening to me because they're running the risk of getting kicked out of the room, right? That's, you know, if we create a parallel to the theological terms, law and gospel, that's the law, that's the rod. I want them to be listening to me because what I've got to say is really interesting in its own merits, and it's something that they say, wow, and they want to get in, you know, they just naturally want to hear more, right? And so that's not a perfect parallel to the gospel, but the idea is that you're not being told you have to do it, you're not being, you know, edged on by this, you know, I don't know, firm, rigid structure, but rather you're yourself saying, this is wonderful, I want to keep down this road.
Yeah, and right away, obviously there's going to be two settings. One is going to be a public school, and one's going to be, you know, a Christian school. And yet in the public setting still, students need to be loved and be told that they're valuable no matter what, so that then they do have kind of a motivation to progress, to say, yeah, I have something to offer, or this world is worth exploring, or something like that. And I imagine that's really hard in a public setting. But Amanda, why don't you jump in about, you know, how can you do grace in a classroom and not just be nice, but an undeserved kind of love?
I think the biggest thing is definitely always coming back to, even when you've had struggles in the day or struggles in the classroom, coming back to, I love you, Jesus loves you. And it's very easy for me to do with 5-year-olds because they tell me about 30 times a day how much they love me, and I get to say it right back to them. And I do mean it. I can't think of a class or a year or even a single student that I truly didn't love as my own. In fact, Mike can attest to this often. I probably treat my students better than I treat my own children because by the time I get home, I think I've exerted all of that love and patience for them and probably don't have enough left over in the tank for my family. I'm working on it. But we mentioned before, I mean, so much of our day is structured around rules, regulations, policies, procedures, stand for this, sit for that, raise your hand, don't raise your hand. And even the reward-based things, you know, you talked about what happens if somebody's not participating or not behaving. And then often teachers take the other side. Well, I'm gonna get everybody listening by rewarding the ones that are. Mm-hmm. Well, there again, what are they listening for? They're listening for that Skittle or that M&M mm-hmm. or whatever it is you're giving them. And I'm guilty of doing it because we're kind of, us teachers, we're flying by the seat of our pants a lot, and we're trying to think of any which way to get our kiddos on board with us because we know the information we're going to give them or the things that we have to teach them is valuable and important, but getting them to that point is kind of what we're talking about. Coming from the Lutheran school setting, We definitely use Long Gospel a lot. We use Sin and Grace a lot. And I try to fit in as much of that as possible, especially when it does come down to disciplinary and situations. And in my world, it's not anything super major. It's maybe if they've had multiple infractions of just talking out of turn or not listening, or if they've hit a friend or whatever it might be. And my goal is to always end every single one of those conversations with them looking me in the eye and reminding them that I forgive them, that Jesus forgives them, and that they're loved no matter what. I mean, is there room for grace? There is, but it's definitely difficult when you feel like you are spending a good chunk of your day talking about rules and laws. And, you know, it's not necessarily just in your whole classroom. It may be a whole school rule. And so even teachers are bound to, wow, I got to follow these set procedures in the hallway and these set procedures at lunch and this, that, and the other thing. And so even if it's not in your comfort zone, you got to be on board with it and get your students on board with it. And that can be a challenge some days.
Yeah, and there's, you have this struggle. It reminds me of an episode idea that I've kind of tossed out to Wade and Ben. I don't know if I've mentioned it to you yet, Mike, but the idea of Paul's question. Paul asks this question in a number of his Gospels. What now shall we sin all the more that grace may increase, right? And in the classroom, you kind of run into this problem where if you tell the students, you have to follow the rules, and now you didn't follow the rules, and, you know, I forgive you, and Jesus loves you, or in public school, just I forgive you, you know, like, it'll be okay. They might come away with the impression, like, well, this was easy, right?
Yeah.
This is why I think it might be a good episode for the podcast, is that people get afraid of that question, because I take them pretty seriously, pretty literally. Like, Paul's asking this question in earnest. And he's obviously says, no, by no means. But that is where we're left at with grace. If you take grace seriously, is that God says all of your sins are forgiven. And so if everything's forgiven, there's truly nothing for me to do, well, then I can do whatever I want, right? That, I mean, like, that's kind of the freedom that you have in kind of a negative sense, in a bad way. And in the classroom, that becomes really dangerous, right? And you say, if the teacher that kind of gets the reputation of being a pushover, right, then all of a sudden he or she is, you know, the students can kind of start walking all over them. And it really comes back to then, well, there's got to be more of a stick or a rod there, you know, and I mean corporal punishment, obviously. We're not in Texas or anything, but but, you know, in terms of, there's going to be consequences, there'll be punishment, you know. I mean, I got to know the principal of my grade school very well. That was during school hours. It was an after school, although my dad was good friends with him, which made it even worse.
Hey, my principal was my dad for a while, both in elementary and in high school.
I think it would have been better if it was my dad. He would have been disappointed with me, but then I wouldn't have had to go home and deal with him again.
Yeah.
You know? That was quite the interesting thing. I had my seventh grade teacher, side story. He had me stay after class a lot. After school a lot, because I walked home, so he knew he could. And one day I was tired of it. I was sick of it. I said, I'm leaving. And I walked out and was storming down the hallway. And he chased me down and tackled me in the hallway. And he's laid on top of me. And he yells to the secretary, get the principal. And he comes out there and he just looks down the hallway. And I'm way on the other end of the hallway. And he goes, Peter, come here. And it was like, oh, it was just like those words just cut right through me. I thought, oh, this is going to be bad, and then I'm going to go home, and it's going to be worse. And that was, well, I don't know, this, I'm getting off topic here, but that was what kept me in line, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
and you knew, though, in that moment, you stopped and you listened because you knew that there was still a love and a caring there. You know, to just speak to what you had said, we definitely have to have follow-through. There has to be consequences, but within the realm of that, I guess it's a loving and caring relationship that you have with those students, and that they know that they can trust you even when they are being reprimanded. I'm by no means a pushover. I guess Mike has seen me in the classroom quite a bit, and I've definitely had my days where I've, you know, felt like, wow, I could have been more patient or whatever. And so it's a fine line. It's a fine line walking that role of being firm and yet gentle and loving at the same time. And I think if you think of Christ, that's essentially what he is. I mean, he's loving but yet firm. I mean, he, like, there's clear-cut, you know, things in the Bible that tell us what we should and shouldn't do, but yet we continue to do them, as Paul said, right? I do the things I shouldn't do, and the things I want to do, I can't do them. And yet the forgiveness still flows every single time.
Yeah, and Jesus says himself, you know, I didn't come to abolish the law, but to fulfill it. He says, I didn't come to judge at places. In the gospel, according to St. John, he makes it pretty clear that the sort of judging that he does is the judgment that light does when it illuminates something. So it's just revealing, right? And so in that way, he's not taking away the sting of the law, you know, qua law. He's taking away the sting of the law for the repentant sinner, right? For the sinner that, you know, has the gift of faith. And so that's very different. it's not saying, oh, it's all okay. It'll be fine. It won't be fine, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I think that the hard part there, too, is, I mean, in the classroom is that we're not dealing with we're dealing both with the sinner and maybe, I don't like this distinction. Wade and I have talked about this, too, but the two kingdoms, right? Mm-hmm. We're dealing with the child in both kingdoms, in a sense, especially at a Christian school. And so in the kingdom, I get them mixed up. Which one's the right? Which one's the left?
Right is a spiritual kingdom. Okay. Left is, yeah.
So in the left, in the left kingdom, the kingdom of this world, we're dealing with them and we can say, no, these are the rules and, you know, and we want you to follow these rules and that's kind of our end goal. But then when we're dealing with them as, you know, as fellow, you know, Christians and sinners who are saints and we're dealing with that, it's a lot more difficult, I think.
Yeah.
And I've never taught at a Lutheran school where I have, you know, share a complete faith statement with my students, but I've taught at an Orthodox school and a Catholic school. And there's a lot of overlap there, obviously, that, you know, we could pull on. We all, for instance, believed in this guy named Jesus and that he was God. And, you know, we had, you know, shared, you know, a lot of those kind of central views. So we could find, you know, some common ground to talk about. It wasn't like we had a Buddhist or something.
Mm-hmm. I think another thing, too, is just, you know, you remind the students they're part of a whole. And there's only one, you know, one teacher. So we often say, you know, there's only one me. And when you're talking with parents, too, when it comes to discipline situations, you know, a good thing to remind them, you know, well, why are these rules so strict or why is this so difficult? You know, why do they have to be so quiet all the time? Well, if you, and most parents don't question it because as you mentioned before, most parents will say, I don't know how you do it all day. And, you know, it's just you and 12 kids or whatever it might be. I've had very positive experiences with all families that I've worked with over the years. I've been very fortunate. But I think just helping everybody understand, too, that kind of 1 in 30 concept, like if all 30 were doing it, it'd be mass chaos, you know? And mm-hmm. So you're just kind of a part of a team, a part of a group, and we are citizens of that room at that point in time, you know? And so maintaining order, maintaining the structure is definitely important. And kids need that structure. They need predictability and they need routine. And so, you know, that helps them too. At the same time, I feel like it's okay to let your guard down once in a while and let them know that, you know, you're human, they're human. Maybe just at this point in time, we need a break from the crazy, you know, the really strict structure and give them a few moments to be just, you know, human beings. And in our society today, we expect so much out of our children, especially our little ones. They're doing way more in kindergarten than they ever had to do before. They're going all day, for example, than, you know, even, well, what was it? 9 years ago, Abigail started kindergarten the very first year that all of Minnesota went to all-day kindergarten. And back then, I had a hard time swallowing that because I knew that that was going to be a lot for a child mm-hmm. her age, developmentally, physically, emotionally. And then you bring spiritually into that, too, because, of course, they're going to act out more when they're tired. They're going to act out more when we're asking them to do things that aren't developmentally appropriate or acceptable for kids their age. And probably now I'm going off on a totally different tangent.
No,
we could take it down that road even further. But I guess, you know, when I think about grace in the classroom, I'm not just talking about pronouncing their sins forgiven in the stead of Christ or talking to them about what Jesus has done for them, which, of course, is a daily thing that we discuss that, you know, I try to get every Bible lesson, every hero of faith that we're learning about in the Old Testament, why those things were happening, and it's connecting them to Christ and the cross. But it's also bigger than that. Grace is also giving them that undeserved love that Christ gives to us. So do they deserve to have extra recess? No. But do they need it? Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, do they deserve to have a cupcake at the end of the day? You know, and so we hold some of that stuff over their heads, and I don't think that's always good. you know, like, you didn't eat all your peas, so you don't get the birthday treat this afternoon. Well, or you didn't get all your homework done, so you can't go on the field trip. Well, those are the same kids that are never going to get to do those things. And they probably aren't getting any of that type of grace or undeserved love necessarily at home either, because in our homes, our lives are busy and stressful, and we got to do this, we got to do that. So I think just choosing those moments wisely and carefully, but giving them the chance to know and feel and see from you as an educator or a parent that there are times for that undeserved love.
One of the things you mentioned, like the heroes of faith and kind of learning those Bible stories, one of the things that is kind of an easy lesson if you're at a Christian school to kind of drive home is that when kids are acting up, and I'm guessing especially with younger kids where you can kind of have a little bit more frank conversation with them, as they get older, they tend to kind of close off if you point that light too, you know, shine it too brightly on their sins. I don't know. But evidently, when you get to be adults, you don't have that problem anymore. No, I think that's part of the maturing process. You're trying to hide your sins. With younger kids, you can kind of put it out there a little more. But all of those heroes of faith, you can point to each of them and you can say, well, what about Abraham? Where did his faith falter? What about, you know, David? Where did his faith falter? You can go through the whole list, right? I mean, and just walk through it and you can say, so all of these people that we look at and that God saw, you know, fit to give us as examples and to tell his story through, all of these people we see failed as well, right? Why didn't Moses get to go into the promised land, right? Moses led the people out of Israel. This is, you know, this is the guy of the Old Testament, right? I mean, he's the one who makes this all happen and gives us the first five books of the Bible and everything like that. And yet he doesn't get to do the one thing that he was, you know, called to do, you know, lead them into the promised land. And you can say, so, you know, this is one place where I'm thinking you can say, hey, you know how you just screwed up. You made a mistake. All these people did. And so as a Christian educator, it's nice. It's such a wonderful opportunity there to really drive it home in kind of the most meaningful way. I wonder how how much that is lacking when you're in a public school setting and you can't, you know, drive that home directly for obvious reasons. And then what do you do? Then does that law still struggle? I don't know if you have any thoughts about that in particular, but
yeah, as far as motivating then without the law and the gospel?
Having the law.
Yeah.
Is there a way around it to...
I think I've seen, you know, the use of just, you know, your love coming from you as the teacher. And even the words, like you mentioned, Mike, using the words, or maybe it was you, Peter, sorry, you know, you're forgiven or it's okay. I mean, I've seen the word forgiveness used. Now, granted, this was rural Minnesota. A lot of people are Christian or Lutheran out there. But, yeah, it's not going to have quite the same full effect. Mm-hmm. Interestingly enough, as I was sitting at a sectional in teachers conference on Thursday, we were in a group of people listening to an excellent speaker about... particularly children with behavioral issues, disorders, or have experienced trauma in their life. And, you know, the list of things that count for trauma are things that you and I would think, wow, that doesn't seem like a big deal, but what it can do to a child if it's done repeatedly, even such things as just, you know, having to move multiple times or having to go without food or not know, you know, those kinds of things. And one of the things that really resonated with me, and it was partly due to the fact that I knew we were doing this podcast, but she just talked about how much law is in those kids' lives, especially because if they do have a behavior disorder, whether it's caused by traumatic experiences or whether it's just a full-on, you know, within their makeup of being a, you know, having a behavior disorder, often they are pegged as, you know, quote unquote, naughty or difficult or a behavior problem or whatever it is. And so they do get a lot of law and a lot of consequences. And so her reminder to us teachers was not just that they get our love, but that they do hear the clear and full message of Christ's undeserved love, because they're not going to get that very many places in their life, whether it's home, whether it's school, whether it's special ed, you know, classroom. And they're, you know, typically kids in our society nowadays are carted to a lot of different places. So they have a lot of different sets of rules to follow. They've got grandma's rules. They've got daycare rules. They've got school rules. They've got home rules. And sometimes it's hard for them to switch gears. But I just thought her point about really making sure they get the clear message of Christ's undeserved love for them, that no matter what, like you mentioned, those sins are washed away, those problems are washed away, and ultimately they'll fully be gone when we get to heaven. And the other point she made, and I found this very interesting because I had never approached it or thought of it this way, was this, that as teachers or parents, caregivers, whatever it might be, we can say, I love you, I forgive you. But what happens if they're not at your school tomorrow? Or what happens if they have to switch classrooms? You're not with them, but Christ is. And so that resonated with me. I thought that was a really good point, that when they know that they are fully redeemed children of God going to heaven, that can't be taken away from them no matter where they are, no matter what classroom, no matter what school, no matter what home. And I hadn't really ever thought of it that way. As often as I've shared Jesus with little children, I hadn't thought of it in the sense of, you know, I'm sending him with them. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know. That resonated with me, and I thought it was worth mentioning here.
Yeah, I think it's important to talk about all the things that children have to deal with today and in past generations, too. Too often we start thinking about, well, we got to have school and structure. They don't get structure in their lives. That may be the worst thing, is that all they have is law or the ramifications of law, because they're living in a life of chaos without actual rules. There's still the law there, because when their parents let them do whatever they want, they still got to get up in the morning, and there's a law there. They're tired. They don't have their homework done and stuff like that. And the answer sometimes is not more law. We should start thinking about them. They've never seen the gospel and the actual gospel and undeserved love. Maybe once in a while when they have a really awful day in your classroom, that's when you give them extra recess just to make a point once in a while. This is what undeserved mercy looks like.
Yeah. So one of the kind of areas of this that really struck me when Mike and I were first started talking about it, and I, just for the listener's sake, so it's a conversation that Mike and Amanda had. Mike brought it up with me, and then Mike and I, you know, had it, and Mike said we should talk about this in the podcast. So, but one of the areas was specifically with grades. I mean, grades seems like it's all law to me, right? I mean, like, this is what you've merited, right? And so, you know, some students that do really well because they work really hard. Some students do really well because they're just very gifted and they don't work very hard, and you feel like, you know, how can I make it harder for them? So they work harder. And then some students that you know, do very poorly but work really hard at it. And you feel like, oh, man. And I know for you, you've taught all ages, but primarily the younger kids, and so it's, grades aren't as important. But for me, that's always the biggest struggle, is when I have a student who works really, I mean, just extremely hard and gets poor grades. And what do I do with that student, right? How do I reflect the quality of his or her effort versus the actual work, the product? And then relatedly, you have the student that is just really gifted and doesn't work hard at all, and maybe is even doing poorly, but you can see so much talent and so much potential there if they just were willing to step in and say, I'm going to do this. But it seems like all of that is the only tool that I have as an educator, as a teacher at that moment, is the law and in the grades, right? And yet there's so much more that I want to tell them. I want to tell the student that is working so hard but getting poor grades, it's not just about your grades. You're doing fantastic work, even if your report card doesn't look like that. I want to tell the student that is getting good grades but obviously very lazy and could do much better, you know, you're getting maybe B's and A's, but you should be straight A. You should be one of the best in the class. You should be leading the group, right? And I want to tell the student that is just kind of blowing everything off but has all this talent, like, you have so much talent and you're wasting it. And eventually, you're not going to be able to come back and say, well, now I want to be a good student, because that time will have passed you by. But it seems like those are all motivated by something more personal, whereas the tool that I have, that I've been given as an educator, is really very much the law. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, no, definitely. It's funny you mention that, because I've been working on assessments and report cards and things like that this week, as the quarter ended last week. And it is. It's a difficult thing, because we have kind of this one way of measuring, and don't even get me started on standardized tests, but you know, we do have to have some baseline, you know, when it comes to knowing where our students are at. And so, you know, testing, assessing is needed, and it's good, and grades. But, you know, I totally agree, because you want to take kids where they're at and push them on to where they can, you know, strive to be better, no matter where they're coming from. And I think that'd be a good place for, you know, somebody to come in and really talk to them about, things like vocation and things like what are your mm-hmm. talents and what are your abilities and what are you good at? Not everybody's good at grades. Not everybody's good at school per se in the sense that we kind of present it to kids. I know some schools and districts, this was happening in Minnesota, have gone to a standards-based grading system where it's not A's and B's and C's and D's anymore. It's like basically a 1, 2, or a 3, and it's up to the teacher and the student to work together to get them to that next point, to get them to a level of understanding, you know, to that next standard. So it's more about meeting the standards than it is about passing the grade, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. In the early childhood level, we're really focusing more on development, and so we have a little more flexibility when it comes to giving those grades. It's a little bit more of a fluid scale, and it's more saying, here's where your child is, here's where, you know, here's the things we're working on and where we need to get them. So I'm grateful for that in my world because I don't have to have it so black and white quite yet. However, because we are sort of expecting more out of kids at a younger age than what they're developmentally ready for, we are already setting kids up for failure at age 5, 4. You know, oh, my kid's not reading. What's wrong with him? You know, mm-hmm. but they're 5 years old. And in a lot of you know, in another time when you and I were kids, we weren't expected to read by the time we left kindergarten. And in a lot of other countries, they're not expected to read yet. Doesn't mean that they can't. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, you know, sometimes we need to realize, too, just because we see some kids able to do it does not mean that they should be doing it at that age.
Mm-hmm. Or that we shouldn't at least hold everyone else to that standard, right?
Right, right. And so, yeah, maybe, you know, that's another area where we can try to bring some grace into the classroom as far as expectations of our students and what is, you know, what's the norm isn't necessarily going to work for everybody. And it's difficult because differentiating your instruction or your expectations is a lot more work on the teacher. It's so mm-hmm. much easier to say, here's the line, everybody needs to toe it, and this is the way it's going to be, and you get an A if you do it, and you get an F if you don't, kind of a thing. Mm-hmm. And so finding that balance, it's tricky, finding that balance. And I'm kind of in a constant struggle with it lately just because I've had to shift gears so much myself as a teacher. I'm doing totally different curriculum, totally different grade level. And so I'm just basically trying to stay afloat myself. And yet I can't be plowing through curriculum just so that I get it done. I need to be seeing my students where they are and meeting their needs personally and individually.
I wonder if this is, you know, standardized testing and stuff like that, to put it into theological terms, teaching towards a law, a standard, rather than teaching towards towards a freedom, you know? And in a Lutheran perspective, we would say the gospel freedom to then go and flourish without worry if I'm going to get an A, B, or C. And I think, Peter, you would have to say something about that, about the educational style, about letting a student go with that freedom instead of saying we're learning not for the sake of learning, we're learning so that we can get you to this certain level so therefore that we can have good test grades for our school.
Sure, yeah. And I mean I will say from my personal experience, I was never a bad student. I mean I was probably a pretty good student, but I just didn't try real hard. And I got to college, and then it was my second year of college. I was taking Greek, and I had a Greek teacher that was, you know, he was pretty hard, and he was not going to let up. And I worked really hard and got a C in the class, and I thought, jeepers, that's the hardest I've ever worked in my life. And it was the second year with that same professor that I said, wait a second, I'm chasing the grade here, but I'm getting a fabulous education, so I'm beating myself up about not getting good enough grades, right? The grades that I was used to. And I'm not recognizing the fact that I'm being educated in a way I've never been educated before in my life. I'm just going to embrace this. And probably not to anyone's surprise who would stop and think about it for 2 seconds, but certainly to my, you know, 19, 20-year-old mind, it was a huge surprise. Almost immediately, my grades went up, right? Because all of a sudden, I was saying, I'm just going to enjoy school, right? I'm going to do it for the love of learning, as you said. And it no longer came, and I wasn't worried about that. And I've told some of my better students that in the past, that, you know, hey, don't worry so much about your grade. Worry about getting what you can get out of it. If I'm not challenging you, let me know, because I want to, you know, I want to challenge you as much as you're capable of. But the grades in that way get in the way. I mean, and this is, again, this isn't a perfect parallel to the law of gospel question in theological terms, but it gets to the point that everything in the classroom seems to just be focused and kind of pointed right at that, you know, the law. How do we how do we manage this? How do we structure this? And grades, I think, just drive that home for me, at least, because as a, you know, on both sides of the grade equation, I've looked at that.
And something that popped in my mind when you were first talking at the beginning of this this section, grace kind of means that the lovers, the person who is loving, the lover, is put into a vulnerable position, mm-hmm. right? Especially for a teacher. I would imagine a lot of teachers have a very strict disciplinary code, partly because they just want to get through the day and they don't want any trouble. And this is what they have used and have learned to manage the classroom. And when you give undeserved love, if you would teach, and this is a little bit easier on college level, obviously, but if you would teach with the idea of freedom of learning for the student in mind, you can be taken advantage of there. Mm-hmm. But that's the risk you take as a person who loves. And if you're going to give grace, maybe your test scores aren't going to be great, or maybe you're going to get burned behavior-wise with some child or with a parent or whatever. But that's what grace is. That's what grace is. So anyway, you want to add maybe one more thought, Peter or Amanda, before we wrap up here about grace in the classroom? I think that'd be nice if you could finish off here.
I had a thought, but then you stole my thunder for a minute there. No, I guess what I was thinking was this, that ultimately, what does grace bring us? It brings us joy. It brings us peace and comfort. And so I think that if we can find those opportunities to give those students the grace and the love that they need, and that little bit of freedom, it should bring more joy in their learning. And there should be joy, like you said, Mike, I mean, as a teacher too, it should be joyful for me. So if it's not feeling joyful as the teacher, if it's not feeling joyful as the students, that might be the first indicator that something's not right. And that maybe it's not necessarily that you can't still have the structure and the firmness, because we all know that there's love in being firm too. We've got to have follow through. We've got to teach our children that there are real life consequences for our behaviors. There's no question. But maintaining that joy, maintaining that love, no matter what level you're teaching, whether it's early childhood, whether it's infants and toddlers, or whether it's college students or high school students, if there's joy in the
there's different college students, well, infants and toddlers.
Yeah, right. So
the differences are smaller than you think.
Yeah. But finding that joy and then the motivation hopefully will come from there, which is what we sort of preach the gospel is, right? I mean, it's Christ's love that motivates us, and his free and undeserved grace and salvation is what gives us the joy and the comfort and the peace to get up every morning to do what we do. And finally, just one other little thought tidbit that came to my mind. I guess one thing that, you know, we talked a little bit about the difference between, you know, a private school education, a Christian education, a public school education, or whatever, you know, whatever world you're coming from. Sometimes those kids, no matter where they are coming from or where you are, what they need is your love. And I heard a really great speaker, phenomenal lady in the world of early childhood education, who just said, you know, one year there was a little one that basically her main goal was just to give that child love. That was her standard. That was her focus. It, you know, if they learned some math and some reading and some ABCs along the way, awesome. But that child needed to know that he was safe and loved and cared for. And that was her curriculum for that kiddo. And so I think maintaining that for all of our students is still a very valuable piece of their day, even if it feels like, wow, I didn't get to anything today. It's okay, because as long as they know you love them and Jesus loves them, you're giving them what they need.
One last encouragement, and then I'll let you finish this off, Mike, is just to educators out there, is if you haven't thought about this, you know, in the past, and I'm sure many of you have, but if you haven't, you know, take some time to just work through it in your own mind and think about different ways that you can do it. And especially if you are in a Christian school, if you're a teacher that is teaching at a Christian school, you have a wonderful opportunity to really drive home the gospel, not just some love, which is good, which is hopefully, if you're Christian, it's a reflection of Christ's love for you, but Christ's love, and you can drive that home and make sure your students get that. And even on those days, and maybe especially on those days when they're really driving you crazy, to bring that back and to let them know. And for everybody there's probably better and different ways to do that, but spend some time, you know, personally thinking about that and how you might do that for your students. Because if nothing else, as Amanda was just saying, at the end of the day, if they walk away and say, well, even if they don't say it, if they just feel it, that, you know, I'm loved, and they see that as a reflection of Christ's love, I mean, there's no greater gift that anyone could give to a child. So,
yeah, I can't help but think about St. Paul's words in 1 Corinthians 13. I keep going back to this phrase, not from St. Paul, but that the goal is not virtue for the sake of virtue, or sanctification for the sake of sanctification, following laws for the sake of following laws, spiritual growth for spiritual growth's sake. But really, it's love. And I think that's what St. Paul meant when he said, you know, if you can do all this stuff without love, you're just a resounding gong. You're just annoying the rest of us. You're just making noise, right? Even if you're the best teacher with the highest, your kids have the highest scores, this, that, or the other thing. Finally, you want to give them the gospel specifically. Know that they have value in love so that they can flourish, so that they can live life in freedom. And you may not, as a teacher, be able to see that. As all teachers know, it's 10 years down the road. It's 20 years down the road when some of those lessons are hit. Finally, we want them to be loved and be content and seen as valuable in Jesus Christ's blood, even though they don't deserve it, so that they can live in freedom. And they can finally
let the bird fly.
Every evening when the sun goes down, get with my party and I begin to clown. I don't care what the people are thinking, I'm not drunk, I'm just a drinker. I set 'em up another round, I set 'em up another round, I set 'em up another round. One more round won't get me down. And I said, honey, I don't care.